I'm Sheila Kast, and this is Midday. In his new book, Dee Watkins is not just observing the East Baltimore drug trade, he's living it and taking us with him. We get to know his family, his drug crew, his customers, his supplier, and the cops who show up sporadically on raids that never seem to change anything. He shows us the desperation and the comedy. Watkins gives us a feel for why he got into drug dealing, what forces led him to leave it, and what risks he faced along the way. The book is The Cook-Up, a crack rock memoir, and Dee Watkins is here to walk us through it on Midday, right after the news from NPR. Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Kast. I'm glad you could be with us today. We're spending the hour with Baltimore writer, former entrepreneur, college professor, and salon columnist Dee Watkins. His big splash as an entrepreneur was running a drug crew in East Baltimore, and that's where he takes us in his new book, The Cook-Up, a crack rock memoir. In words that grab our attention and move fast, he shows us how to score a connection, cook up crack, evade the cops, and impress girls. He lets us in on why he got into the game and how he got out. It's a great read. What you might not expect is that this former drug dealer holds two master's degrees, one in education from Johns Hopkins, plus an MFA in creative writing from the University of Baltimore. He's a founder of the Be More Writers Project, was named Best Writer of 2015 by Baltimore Magazine, and is a professor of creative writing at the University of Baltimore and professor of education at Johns Hopkins. Welcome back to Midday.
Hey, thank you. Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure to be on your show.
It's good to see you again. Okay, I have no idea whether anything in this book is true. The world that you're describing is so far from mine. The more colorful the dialogue, the more amazing the characters, the more I thought, is he pulling my leg? How much of this is true?
All you got to do is just, like, go down to East Baltimore and hang out and talk to some people, you know, see what their reality is like. One thing I will say, and it's like might scare a lot of people, is that people have way, 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 way more scary realities than I've had coming up. Way more scary. Like, this is like the tip of the iceberg. It gets worse.
There are some scary moments, but you're right. It's probably scary as I would have assumed a drug dealer's life.
People think, like, you know, they look at me and they see how I communicate now, and, you know, they see some of the things that I went on to accomplish, and they say exactly what you say. And that comes from the people who are caught up in these situations like I was. In the book, they're just not really expected to ever be anything, and making it out is almost like a joke or like a lie or like something that just can't really happen because it's not supposed to happen. So it's like I get hit with that like a lot, you know. It's rough, and it's one of the reasons why we briefly spoke before we started, but it's one of the reasons why I won't leave East Baltimore, because like I have to do my job. Like I have to work really, 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 really hard to have an impact and be accessible and be a person who people can look at and say, yo, he came through the streets, man. And, you know, he's been shot before and he's been on these blocks, but he made it out. He made it out of here. And, but at the same time, he didn't make it out because he's right here being an example for us and helping us, you know, pull through too.
Well, let's, before we get too far away from what people who haven't read the book yet know, let's kind of walk through some of it. The book starts when your older brother, Bip, is killed. And that tells us right away how high the stakes are. He was a drug dealer, very successful until he was shot. He never wanted you to go into the drug business. Why did you?
You know, so that's like an illusion that like that's sold too, is that like the average drug dealer is like setting up a little drug dealer career days in a neighborhood with like a table and applications and photos of what you can accomplish if you make it. But there was a lot of guys like my brother who didn't want any young people or like a lot of us coming up under him to participate in that, because, you know, he chose that for his life, but he thought that, you know, some of us, especially me, like, I didn't have the skills to really make it in the street. And I actually really don't. Like, you know, I could not even participate in that lifestyle if I wasn't, if I didn't have, I had so much trauma and so much depression and so much pain on my, you know, my bony 17, 18 year old shoulders that, like, that's the only thing that gave me the ability to even be able to enter that world and try to be something in that
world. You're saying you were so depressed about, yeah, about your brother's death.
Yeah, if I was in the right frame of mind, if I was just like a kid, you know, living like a regular type lifestyle with, like, you know, surrounded by people who really, like, you know, like, loved me a lot and cared about me and like, you know, helped me figure out what my passions or, you know, or if I even had any talents. If I had that type of reality, I wouldn't even think about that world. But that wasn't my reality. My reality was something completely different.
Well, right after Bip's death, you did try to follow the course he would have wanted for you. You did start college. You'd been accepted a bunch of places. You decided to go to Loyola.
Yeah,
you didn't want to go too far from home.
Yeah, I wasn't the worst high school student. You know, when I was in the 10th, 11th grade, I really started planning to, like, yo, okay, I know this teacher and this teacher and that teacher don't like me, but I know this teacher and that teacher have resources. They went to great schools. I see the little pennants on their wall. You know, they went to places like Hopkins and they went to places like, you know, so some of these people have resources and connections and they could help me. So I need to stay away from the classes where it's a teacher that's wasting everybody's time and, you know, telling us we're not going to be anything, and learn how to make friends and build with the teachers who had these experiences. So that's kind of how I was able to, like, get accepted into, you know, a couple of colleges. And I was really proud of that. And then, you know, some people in my family and some of my friends were like, yo, you should just go ahead and give it a shot. Like, you should just try. And I really tried. But I think that.
Well, tell us about that. It was most of a semester. It wasn't even a semester.
But when I was there, I just
felt. This is at Loyola.
Yeah, at Loyola, I felt like an alien. You know, I felt like, I just felt like, you know, a person from my type of situation shouldn't really be there. And that's not even, it's no fault of the school. And it wasn't my fault. It's just the city has been segregated and split up like that for years.
One of the things you write is that you had never been around white people.
Nah, when you come from East Baltimore, the only white people you're probably going to know is like a couple housing police, some teachers, and then like some, you know, some white people in Highlandtown, but you don't really, like, well, it used to be some white people in Highlandtown. Highlandtown is a little different now. But you don't really have those relationships and, you know, there's a big difference. And, you know, the funny thing about it is that there's these gray areas that connect us all, but you're just so focused on how different you are that it kind of prohibits you from building those types of connections.
And so at some point you, well, I guess really the event that gave you away a reason to leave college was you opened Bip's safe.
Yeah, and I knew it was something in there. Like, I knew it was cash. You know, I didn't know if it was, like, I didn't know what I was going to find, but I knew it was some stuff in there. And, you know, I had that decision. I wanted to die. You know, I wasn't going to kill myself, but I was hoping that somebody else would do it. I wanted to make money. I wanted to have fun, and I wanted to just follow. I just wanted to be, you know, I just wanted to be, like, I know I wasn't in my right frame of mind, and I know I didn't really want to live at that time. Like, and so I wasn't doing things to, like, I wasn't out there, like, bullying people and knocking people around. But I knew that, you know, I got a reputation for not, everybody knows this. Like, I wouldn't even kill, like, a bug, really. I've always been that guy that, like, I don't even kill the roaches. Like, I'm not going to hurt anybody. And if a person like me can, this is the logic. If a person like me can have this type of hold on this type of area, then somebody's going to want it and they're going to kill me. And that's kind of what I wanted.
You've kind of leapt over. I was going to ask you what was in that safe. Mm-hmm. You've kind of taken us to where you were, like, the day after you opened the safe. I mean, What was in there? You said you expected money.
Money, drugs, some photos.
Guns?
Some guns. It's pretty much like a starter kit.
Like a starter kit.
Like a dope boy starter kit, like a drug dealer starter kit, like a trust fund. It's like a street trust fund.
Yeah, you use that phrase.
I could have flushed it.
A trust fund baby.
I could have flushed it in the toilet. Couldn't give it to the cops. They probably would have beat me down and locked me up. I could have done anything with it, but I said, you know what? I'm just going to go ahead and I'm going to live out the life that I think I'm supposed to be living out. Like, I'm just going to be exactly the type statistic that I'm supposed to be, because I can't fit in at a white college, you know? And then I had some friends from the hood. I knew some people from the hood that went to like HBCUs, and there's like a whole different type of like, there was a different type of like a black bourgeoisie, and like different, you know, third, fourth, fifth generation Morehouse. Like, I'm not going to fit in there either. The only place that I'll ever fit in is right here on these streets. The only place where success is for me is on these streets. The only place that I'll ever be anything is on these streets. So this is where I'm going to be, and this is what I'm going to do, and I don't really care. And the crazy thing about it is I have all this school. I've done all these things. I've been to all these different places, and the only place I feel success and the only place I feel like I could get real love from is the neighborhoods where I come from. And now I'm just there under a different capacity. I'm not peddling drugs. I'm peddling literacy, and I'm pushing creativity, and I'm pushing storytelling. But it's like the only place I really feel love at.
That's Dee Watkins here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his new book, The Cook-Up, a crack rock memoir. And you can be part of this conversation. Would you like to talk to Dee Watkins about what he remembers, what he lives in East Baltimore? You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'd like people to get a feel for how you write and why this is such a good read. On page 59, you're describing part of your drug crew. I thought if you started that second paragraph and read through the rest of that short chapter.
Okay. Now, don't let TV shows and hood movies lead you to believe that drug crews only consist of childhood friends with crackhead parents who came up poor in some housing projects and frustrated with their living situation by the age of 16, so they decide to be kingpins. And don't let the news fool you into believing that we are all bloodthirsty killers who only sell dope and stay ready to shoot stuff up. Fox and MSNBC and CNN like to portray us as B-roll footage of skinny teens in sweatsuits with gold teeth and AKs. That's not the case, either. It doesn't work like that. A hustler staff could include 8-year-old kids who play with Ninja Turtle dolls, awkward teens, Comcast employees who hate their shift managers, mothers who really want to find work but can't, grandmas raising 3 generations of kids at the same time, cops, the prettiest girl from your high school, the Little League basketball coach for sure, city workers who want a little something extra at the end of the week, junkies, and basically anyone else who seems loyal, because you can never really tell.
And you go on.
Did you want me to finish the chapter?
Well, I think it's pretty fascinating. Yeah,
okay.
I think
okay.
Let's.
Everybody has a breaking point. And even dudes who have been tested for a stranger could take 30 years for you while your best friend is in the next room ratting, crying, gargling on his own snot while explaining the whole operation. The no snitching thing is a facade, and it's evident when you look at incarceration rates. The street corner retention ratio is too low to build lifelong relationships and unbreakable bonds. Y'all could be on today and off tomorrow. I'd even argue that it's better to work with strangers just in case you have to throw them out of a window one day. Who would you ever throw out of a window? Some Comcast guy or your childhood best friend?
We're going to pick this up after a break. More with Dee Watkins reading from and talking about his new book, The Cook-Up, a crack rock memoir. Does this description of drug life in East Baltimore ring true to you? What would you like to ask Dee Watkins? Send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm here in the studio with East Baltimore writer and college professor Dee Watkins. We're talking about his latest book, out just this month, The Cook-Up, a crack rock memoir. You were reading from kind of how you figured out how to set up a crew to sell drugs. And tell me about this crew. You can't describe every single member of it, but I mean, what were you looking for?
This is one issue that I had when writing this book, is who to select to write about and who not to write about. Because retention ratio, like I said, is low. You can't retain. People are always dying. They're always going to jail, or they're always switching careers. So for me, the first draft of this book had like 55 secondary characters. Because that's how life in the city is. And even I got a New York Times book reviewed for this. And like the guy who did the review was saying the same thing. He's like, well, these people, you know, people pop up. And it's kind of like that. So if I can summarize the whole experience, I would say that crews change weekly. It changed weekly sometimes. Some people were there for a little longer, but then a lot of people faded. And these people weren't super predators. They're not super predators. It's a made up thing. That's a lie. These are regular people. Like, when I think about this book, so I don't glorify selling drugs, but I also don't demonize the people caught up in these realities, because a lot of us don't know anything else. And it's true. And that's through policy. That's through poor schools. That's through lack of exposure. That's through, you know, all of the different things that close us in. So it's like,
I want to pick up on that at some point, but first I want to include Adila into this conversation. She's called us from East Baltimore. She wants to pick up on your college experience. Adila, welcome to Midday.
Hi, how you doing?
Great.
Hey, how you doing, Adila?
Good. I was just listening to you talk about going to an HBCU, and I feel like I experienced the same type of thing as far as meeting these people from, you know, they fourth or fifth generation, their family been in college, they know what to do. It's like I had to really kind of go on my own and really read what I was getting into, because I would go take a class. I didn't understand what the teacher was talking about. I didn't understand how they could actually be able to do this type of math. I didn't get it. I went to public schools, and I would take a class. I would drop it, then I would take it again, then I would come back and, you know, try to pass it again. And it was just really difficult for me. But after, I graduated. It took me about 7 years. And I have a bachelor's degree from Morgan. So, you know, I really feel what you were saying.
Thank you. Can I respond to that?
Sure.
It's one of the reasons.
Thanks, Adila.
It's one of the reasons why I can't leave Baltimore City. Like, I have to be a mentor, because there's a lot of kids from Baltimore City who are still first generation, and they need somebody who they can talk to that has had some of those experiences. They need us to, you know, put that literature out there so they can, even if they can't directly reach us, or if we haven't built a relationship, there can be something established, something that they can read to let them know that they're not really alone. It's another reason why I like what really, really admire what Wes Moore is doing with Bridge EDU. You know, he's changing that first year experience to a lot of people who aren't fourth, fifth, and sixth generation college and all that. So it's like, it's great. It's great work.
Adila, I appreciate the phone call. I do want to pick up on, and you deal with this at different, you refer to this at different places in the book. I don't know that you actually sort of confront it head on, but I suspect many of our listeners are listening and saying, like, how can he be comfortable having been a drug dealer? How can he, do you feel guilty about this? I mean, you show us some Robin Hood experiences where you bought things for the kids in the neighborhood, or took the kids in the neighborhood on outings, and how you were able to help some of the people in the neighborhood who were kind of members of your crew, although not really on your payroll. Mm-hmm. But you were contributing to a system which you yourself show us what pain it generates.
It is pain. It's pain and it's difficult. But then, you know, I'm also like, I'm not a naive or a foolish person. I know exactly why I was created. Like, I know where that reality came from. I know the factors that led me to that. I know what society does to Black people in this country, Like, I know it. I've lived it firsthand experiences. And it's like in all fairness, I love the work that I'm doing now. And I think it's important. And I think I've made a difference in a lot of individual lives. I have stacks of letters and things from school teachers and young people who love the things that I read. So I'm always going to be like inspired by that, and that's going to push me to go further. But at the same time, it's like somebody will say that about a drug dealer, but they won't say it about how do you feel comfortable being a president killing innocent people? How do you really feel comfortable owning a pharmaceutical company? How do you really feel comfortable knowing that you're walking into a classroom as a teacher every day and creating generations of people that won't succeed because of your laziness and your poor lesson plans? How do you really sleep at night owning a McDonald's, right? How do you really, really sleep at night owning a McDonald's? How? Like, how? And you know what it does. And you know that the people you're serving, for the most part, don't know any better. They don't even know what they're consuming because it's a tradition that got passed down to them, and it got passed down to them. So it's like, all of these things are flawed and all of these things are horrible. But the key is, like, once I realize the error of my ways, you know, I've worked really, really hard to be different. I work hard to try to make things right, and I'm accessible. So I sleep, you know, really well at night when I decide to go to sleep. It's like, it works for me because it's like, I understand where my mentality was. I understand where my low self-esteem came from. I understand where my lack of confidence came from. And I understand where my sense of community came from. And I can trace all of these things back to slavery. I can trace these things back to schooling. I can trace these things back to white people who were allowed to create these suburbs out of the GI Bill versus Black people like me dumped in public housing. Like, I can trace these things to policy. I can trace these things to American history. And I can trace these things to tradition. So I know exactly why I was in a situation where I came from. But at the same time, I can also say, well, just because all of these things are wrong and they happen to you, now that you know that you're bringing a whole different level of pain, what are you going to do to fix it? And I kind of judge myself based on what I know.
And you think writing can fix it?
I mean, it has been fixing it. Like, I was just like, everywhere I go, like, school teachers are like assigning a B-side from the B-side. So this is, you know, the Cook Up is going to be way bigger than the B-side. But the B-side is my only point of reference because it's my first
book. The B-side is the collection of essays that you published last year.
And when I go to these schools, like, the teachers are crazy because, like, they in their whole career, some of them have been teaching 20, 30 some years, and they never had a book that students, Black students in the inner city, finished in 2 or 3 days. It's working. They're telling their own stories. They want to be journalists. They want to be storytellers. They want to understand the role that writing and using reading as a skill to develop those complex thinking skills and how that can affect their life and the decisions they make. So it's working. It's working good enough. It's working good enough in the schools that I should be assassinated based on social reproduction and how capitalism feeds off of, like, this monster of ignorance tax that it does to poor communities. And when I say ignorance tax, I mean, like, payday loan places, high interest car loans, all of these things that plague low income communities. I'm doing enough to help. I'm working really, really hard.
You're subversive.
To help create a generation of thinkers that won't fall victim to all of these ills that wrap their neighborhoods tight. So it's like, it's working.
So you're saying you're subverting some of the patterns that lead to profits for people
working
outside
really
the community.
Hard. I'm working really hard at it.
Jonathan has called us from Crofton. Jonathan, welcome to Midday.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah, we hear you.
Hi. I'm calling because basically I was kind of in a similar situation, not nearly as bad. I got a BFA in creative writing, but I've also got addicted to drugs. And so I'm sort of trying to struggle with that. And I feel like if I can, you know, really immerse myself in writing and doing volunteer work and stuff like that, pertaining to writing especially, I can sort of, you know, help wean myself off and, you know, help my recovery process. So living in Crofton, I'm wondering if, you know, there are opportunities to go to Baltimore and do the type of work that you're doing so that I can sort of
you know, get back into a regular steady life.
And Jonathan, are you in recovery?
Not yet, but I'm planning on going very soon.
What would you say to Jonathan?
I think there's a whole lot of opportunities in Baltimore. There's like new writing programs popping up. There's a thriving writing community here. On my website, it's under construction right now, but we're about to launch a workshop where we're going to have different groups of dedicated writers come in and build a community of writers and then workshop our projects with each other and share opportunities and share resources and share editors and share these different things to create like a real community here in Baltimore City on top of the other communities that already exist. So I think...
give us the details on that.
So right now it's still being created. My website for young people, it just was recently launched and we're uploading narratives on there now. And that's bemorewp.com. So that's a new thing that we're just...
bemorewp.com.
Yeah, when we first built the site, we were making it for people to upload their own stories. But now I'm trying to train these young journalists to be able to go out and document the stories and upload them in high-quality film and to make them look really nice and everything. So we're working on that. We only have like 3 or 4... narratives up there right now, so we're going slow, but we're paying the students for the work they do. So that's what I'm doing with I'm working with Viewfinders and then a couple of kids from Baltimore City Public Schools. So we're a small team and we're building that now on my own personal website, which is d-watkins.com. There's going to be a tab where we're going to create a workshop, but you know, it's going to be different groups of workshops so that people can be consistent. Like, I don't want to work with like 50, 60 writers at a time, but maybe like 2 or 3 groups of like 5 to 10 writers a piece who are all going to keep in contact with each other. They're all going to share their work. They're all going to try to like work hard to develop that writing community.
And is d-watkins.com up?
Yeah, it's up right now, but right now it's just a picture of the cook-up because I'm having a whole site redone to like kind of focus on some of the community work, some of my the community work, and then like a nice calendar so that people can keep up with my events, because I've been traveling a lot and like people are always like, well, when are you coming to Philly, when are you coming to Atlanta, yada yada yada, and I could just direct them to the site.
It's Dee Watkins, the author and professor here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his latest book, The Cook-Up, a crack rock memoir. Mike has called us from Baltimore. Mike, welcome to Midday.
Yes, hi, Ms. Cass. Hi, Dee.
Hey, how you doing, Mike?
Good. I'm glad to hear you flesh out some of the titles and things that I'm seeing as you are making your way. I hate to put you up a bit in comparison to a fellow from the West Side, but I heard Ta-Nehisi Coates talk about how he sees himself as a chronicler of what he experienced, and that he leaves it to others. For instance, of course, he talked about the reparations piece, and he sees himself as a chronicler as opposed to an implementer. In a way, you sort of answered the question just from what you were talking about with your workshops, but... maybe you could talk a little bit more about what you think do you see yourself as an implementer? And I guess I also would ask, you know, what was the light that turned where you went from underground economy to, above ground kind of stuff?
Thank you, Mike. Great questions. I think, I knew all 250 people that were running for mayor of Baltimore City. You know, some of them were friends. Like, I've met with some of them. We've had conversations, and they would talk to me about how I feel about politics and what I like to play a role in some of the things that they were doing. And it's like, I got super love for Nick Mosby, and I'm great friends with DeRay McKesson. And all of these people, Joshua Harris, they're all great, really, really nice people who wanted to make a difference. And I told them all, like, with love, that's really not my lane. Like, I've been in these streets forever, and nothing has ever trickled down to my neighborhood. So it's like, even, you can have a black president that sets aside money to create jobs in black communities, and it still doesn't trickle down to the black community. So it's like, I'm not saying that policy is important, and I've worked with voter registration I worked with like voters registration drives and things like that, but I don't think I'm the guy to do it. I think I've been more effective working outside of the school system. So like I had a meeting with the school system about making one of my books required reading, and they were all for it, and they said they wanted to do it, but then when it came time to do it, it's like everybody disappeared. And I'm not even attacking them for disappearing. It's crazy that if you see a school, if you're at a school, and if you go to these schools and you talk to these teachers that have assigned my work, and you see the reactions of those students, and you see what they say and how they stand up and speak and yell and scream, and, you know, if you see it but you don't run towards it, you shy away from it, or you make excuses, then you kind of don't really want to make a difference. So it's my job to work outside the system, and I'm comfortable there because, you know, I'm like an outsider anyway. So I definitely agree with Colts on that. And then as far as, like, the second part of the question, I started getting outside of my neighborhood and having relationships with people that were exposing me to different things. And I realized that my neighborhood was this big. And East Baltimore and West Baltimore, you can't even see them on a globe. You can't even see them on a map. And it's like, then I also learned that, you know, like, I just started feeling like when I started traveling to different places, I felt like I had more of a purpose, and I didn't want to die, and I didn't want to sell drugs, and I didn't want to tear my community apart, and I wanted to be something. I just didn't really know what that was.
Mike, I appreciate the call. You mentioned Ray McKesson. I read the interview that you did with him. You interviewed him for The Root.
Yeah, great guy with great ideas, really intelligent.
So what does it say to you that he ended up with 2.6% of the vote, less than he got about 3,500 votes?
I think that the issue with that was he just needs more time in the city. I think if he had, you know, if he had a good 4 to 8 years of, you know, in the city, then he could have gotten like a bigger piece of the vote, maybe even won, you know, because when people get to know him, they're like super impressed. He's intelligent. He has a lot of great ideas, but it's like, I can write the best book in the world. But if I don't know how to get it out there and let people know that I'm trying to write at this level, then I'm only going to get 2% of the sales. You know what I'm saying? Teachers, a lot of people discover my books. They discover my books after they discover, like, the Coates book, because they get, like, an interest in Baltimore. But when it comes time to, like, give the assignments to their students, they're using my book because it's more accessible than, you know, that academic style. It's more accessible. It's more accessible to people who you want to get excited about reading. So it's like, but he's also been in the game way longer. So it's like, you need more time to develop those relationships and to really get out there to win. And that's the key. This is like, you know, DeRay's, his presence across like the world is humongous. Everybody know. I'm speaking in Tulsa, Oklahoma. I'm speaking in Jonesboro, Arkansas. I'm at a community center in Lorain, Ohio, in the back of Ohio. And people are like, hey, you know DeRay? So it's like everybody around the world knows him, but Baltimore is a big local yokel town. So you gotta get on the ground and hit some of these churches and hit some of these, you know, these little, all of the local yokel things that's popping around town.
We need to take another quick break here. We're going to be back after a short break with East Baltimore writer Dee Watkins, and with your calls and questions. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. I'm here in the studio with college professor, East Baltimore writer Dee Watkins. We're talking about his latest book, The Cook Up, a crack rock memoir. And you know, Dee, this is not only a lesson in economics, the economics of the drug trade, but in criminal justice. You were, as near as I can tell, you would meet the definition of a kingpin during the time you were running this. I mean, you were moving, I think, a fair amount of drugs. You never got arrested. How did that happen?
Well, I was arrested when I was a kid. So, you know, I've been through the system as a child.
What does it tell us about the way the system works, that you could be doing what you were doing?
It's very simple. It's relationships and adaptability. So, you know, if you make noise, you know, if you make a noise in a certain way, and this is like resistance against the system, they're going to hear it and they're going to suck you in. I wasn't on the streets for a really long time, but when I was there.
How long were you doing? Under
2 years.
Okay.
So, like, when I was there, you know, if you got caught with drugs and you gave a police officer a gun, they would let you go.
I don't get that. Explain that to me.
Okay, so let's just say, you know, it's Sheila's cast out on the over the project selling drugs, right? You out there, you know, you chilling, and
that would work.
And the police, they roll up on you, and you get caught with, like, you know, 30 vials of crack in your pocket, right?
Yeah.
He would say, Sheila, I'm not gonna arrest you now. He'll take your drugs, some of them. And he'll say, look, I'll give you 3 hours. Come up with a handgun, and I'll let you go. So you would just go and find a pistol, and you would, like, put it in the bushes, and you'll say, officer, you know, insert whatever name right there, officer, whatever, McGillicuddy, officer McGillicuddy, the gun's over there in the bushes, and he will pick that gun up, and that should get out of jail free card.
And this is because
the city was worried about murders and guns. They didn't care if you did drugs until your eyelids fell off. They were worried about the murders. They wanted to get the murder rate down.
But you didn't even. It's not that they took from you the gun that was on you, because you pretty much always had a gun on you.
Well, when I got to that point, I didn't always have it on me. I always had it around me, but not on me. And it's funny because my friends and I, we had this thing where we collected a whole bunch of pistols, and it was just for the purpose of giving to police officers when people got caught. It kept a lot of people out of jail. A lot of people were leery of it, but then when we started seeing that it was working, it was like a lot of people weren't really. One thing too is like, well, I guess I didn't do a good enough job of explaining, is I'm just one guy, and that's just one little crew. There might be like 10 different crews in the same neighborhood. So when they talk about these RICO laws and it's like this, like, you know, these big gang organizations, it's not. Baltimore holds true to tradition. It's a city of neighborhoods that developed out of necessity. It's a city of neighborhoods. So there's no big conglomerate, big type of. These are just a bunch of guys who are just trying to make a couple dollars.
Lots of people who want to be part of this conversation and have phoned us. You can too. 410-662-8780 is our phone number. midday@wypr.org is our email address. Fatima, or is it Fatima, has called us from Baltimore. Mm-hmm. Welcome.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment. I was really impressed with the way you answered the question, Dee, as to how could you, and the parallels that you drew, corporate America and other big businesses, and how could they do what they do in terms of exploiting marginalized people around the issue of food, around the issue of the economy or the non-economy, as it would be in poor urban neighborhoods. And I find it very interesting that people are so interested in wanting to know the nuances of what goes on in a quote-unquote a street drug dealer's life, but no one seems to be, there's no rallying cry to create a avenue or a condition where is people don't have to build this kind of economy in order to survive. I was particularly struck by the conversation about going to school and my word, not yours, feeling somewhat like an alien. You can't know how many young people have said to me, I don't fit in, because they haven't been anywhere beyond West Baltimore. They haven't been anywhere beyond East Baltimore. So I think it's more important, and I love the work that you're doing and the way you're staying stuck in East Baltimore so you can be a beacon of light. But I think the focus needs to be not so much on what a drug dealer is doing, but how to create an avenue for people to have other choices other than being drug dealers. And that's my comment.
Thank you.
Thanks, Fatima.
Thank you. I've been able to use that platform to a certain extent to be able to get some positive things done. But I'm actually like, this is like my last stint with even touching on my own personal story, because I'm so interested in other stories. And I saw that come true. Like the other week, I gave away 500 free books. I wrote a book called Baltimore Sun, And there was some essays I published in the Baltimore Sun, and then like a new essay I wrote just for the book. And my partner with Red Almonds, I had 500 copies made up. And I did that because I go to book events all over the country. And what I learned is that a lot of people like to come to these events, but they can't afford to buy books. And, you know, from my own research, I know that children who grow up in homes with books actually go farther in life than kids who don't, even if no one reads them. So I had the idea of giving away 500 free books. And I partnered with Red Almonds, and we had the books made up. We both put our money up, and we had a big event where I did a reading and opened up the platform for some other local artists. And then I gave away the books and sat there until the store closed and signed every single last book. So it's like, but the news line, the story that came out in the paper was ex-drug dealer gives away 500 books. And I'm like, I'm a college professor too. Like, I'm a writer. Like, I've written for CNN. I've been a commentator. Like, I'm consulting Jada Pinkett on a film. And the best thing you can come up with.
But you just wrote a whole book about being a drug dealer. Didn't you expect that label to stick with you?
I did. I mean, at this point, I mean, yes and no, because I think I've, you know, I've done some other things too. So, but I guess, I mean, it is what it is. It is what it is.
Susan has called us with a question. Susan from Baltimore, welcome to Midday.
Thank you.
You're on the air.
Dee talked about having sold drugs because it was all he knew. I wondered what his advice would be to those who are selling in order to put bread on their tables for their families.
Interesting question, Susan. What would you say to people?
It's a difficult question because, again, there's so many people who don't really know any other way of making money. It's like selling drugs in this city is often the only job that's hiring. You know, people, they don't even understand the reality of 97% of the people in Baltimore born in poverty, die in poverty. So what I would say to them is it's almost like I can't say anything directly to them because I don't have the money to change their situation. But I want to talk. What I would say is something to the politicians and the people who have the power to help bring job training into these neighborhoods and help people be able to do things to help change their lives. You know, it's like it's up to people like myself who has figured out a lane to engage people who are going through those situations, and I'm doing it. So my words wouldn't go to the person. In that reality, my words would go to the people who has came up through the streets or who understands the issues that people are going through but not doing anything about it. We got to pull each other up. My grandmother used to always say, you never look down on somebody unless you're pulling them up. And it's like, you know, it's never going to come from the government. It's not going to happen from the government. Like, they can create trickle-down zones in all of these neighborhoods, and nothing's ever going to trickle down. So it's like, how do we help other people change that situation? So I fought myself for that. I can't even, like, it's like, I'm not going to blame, like, a rape victim because, you know, she's a pretty woman. Like, we gotta get to the point where more so-called activists and community leaders or people who have had success, we gotta share our resources and our skills to pull people out of those situations. So I support that person that's doing that, but not support the negativity, but supporting whatever I can do to help them change that situation. And it's such a big problem that I can only do but so much. I'm just like one guy with like 12 jobs.
I think Phil from East Baltimore is calling us with a question very much on that point. Phil, welcome to Midday.
Welcome, AD. You sort of talked a couple of things this afternoon. One was when you've tried to interface with folks like the school system, there's a lot of enthusiasm, but it doesn't seem to happen.
A bunch of photo ops. They love the photo ops.
Well, and other things turn out to be more free dinners than help. Besides buying your books so that you can, you know, generate some income so you can generate, you know, donate things backwards, you know, you're sort of talking like a lot of friends of you have that do better and are more welcomed outside of Baltimore than inside of Baltimore,
mm-hmm.
That people pay more attention to you outside of Baltimore than inside of Baltimore. Are there specific things that people can be helping you with, not telling you what to do, but helping you with, so that you can have more of an impact here where you clearly love?
Yeah, absolutely. A number of things. One, if you go to bemorewp.com, it's the Baltimore Writers Project. Right now we're still developing. We have a couple of videos up there, but it's going to be a bunch of videos. And the kids who, they're high school kids who are filming and editing these videos. And they work with Viewfinders, who is like a partnership between an organization called Viewfinders and Micah Place. So, like, we collect donations to run this website. We're not, you know, the only money that we're able to pay the kids with is grant money or what we get from donations. So that's one thing. If you don't want to give money, I do a lot of work out of Rare Emma's. And if you have, and this is a really cool thing, not books that people don't want, but if you have books that has made a difference in your life or you know has made a difference in the lives of young people, I want to start. You can drop them off at Emma's and they'll get them to me and I'll get them into the hands of the people who need to read them.
This is Red Emma's. This is Red Emma's.
Red Emma's on North Avenue. Yeah, we're gonna be collecting books. And you know, I'm so inspired by the turnout of my free book giveaway that I want to make it a thing. I just want to make it a thing. Like, I want to make it something that we can do all of the time. One of my friends is this photographer. Everyone knows him, Devin Allen. If you know people that have cameras to give or donate, all of the information is up on his social media. By Devin Allen, just take all the vowels out. And if you have cameras to donate, he collects the cameras and he gives them to kids that he works with. And he's collected hundreds of cameras and has been accessible and made a difference in the lives of a lot of different people. I've also been working to try to get like more books and information that has been transformative to organizations like Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, because they have a direct connection with kids. And if someone like donates me some books, like Anna Castro donated some copies of the B-side, and I wasn't able to get them to Renaissance Academy because me and the social worker, I guess we just couldn't connect, but I was able to get them to Adam Jackson and he got them in the hands of kids who needed them.
Phil, thanks for the call. We're down to just a couple of minutes, and I did want to mention one other thing I learned in your book, that lead paint is sweet, and kids peel it off and eat it like candy. Mm-hmm. How did you escape lead poisoning?
I know. I got lead poisoning.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I ate a fair amount of paint chips. Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, I just didn't get the big check.
Wow.
But some of my friends did. Some of my homies did. Some of my siblings, so, you know.
I'm sorry to hear that, but you're...
I mean, like, I'm good.
You're coping
okay
with it.
Yeah,
well. As I said, we are on our last minute.
What if I didn't have lead, right? I mean, like at Harvard or something.
You're doing pretty well, Dee. A couple of callers want to commend you, and unfortunately, we don't have the airtime for all of them. But Nicole in Towson particularly wants to know what the timeline is for your website.
Under 2 weeks.
Oh, so you're,
it's
you're
like
right
pretty
there.
Much done. I just got to make sure the images are right. Like, I'm at the point now where it's like selecting. We're trying to find all of the photos where I'm not funny looking to use on the site. Once we get through that phase, it's going to go live. So it's under 2 weeks.
What's your next book?
So far under wraps right now, my publishing company is pitching me this idea on having a book where Cornel West and I have 5 hours of conversations on like different types of activism.
Okay, you'll let us know when it comes to me.
I'll let you guys know.
Dee Watkins, author of The Cook Up, a crack rock memoir. Thank you so much for spending the hour with
Always
us.
Always a pleasure.
I'd also like to thank the Diz for supplying lunch today for Midday Guests. The Diz is located at 300 West 30th Street in the heart of Remington and features signature burgers, wings, steaks, jumbo lump crab cakes, open for lunch and dinner with breakfast on weekends on the web at thedizbaltimore.com. And thank you for listening. Tune in tomorrow. We're going to look at the effect of the sex offender registry has when kids are labeled sex offenders, sometimes for behavior that's pretty much normal kid behavior. Be with us for that. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay tuned now for Here and Now.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.